My Buddhist friends, all of us who know the summer school love and honour the speaker of the night. Some of us have known him for many years in the Buddhist society. I've had the privilege of loving and honouring him for nearly 50 years. He's been one of our great teachers, one of our great writers. His own book, you can have if you wish, Early Indian Religious Thought, Sanskrit Buddhism sometimes called, in which he is a master. There's another great work on the way. He tells me that tonight his subject will be difficult at times, but that he's going to elaborate it in his own time tomorrow morning and in his own class later on. We have the privilege of having with us also tonight, visible in front of me, the work of another master, or should I say mistress, Miss Stella Coe, the greatest authority in Europe on Japanese flower arrangement, who fills our building day by day from early morning till late at night, with the exquisite craft of which she is a master, tells me that tonight the title of her work on the table before me is that of the lecture tonight, The Star and the Bubble. So you are seeing what later you will hear, Mr. Rojmeta.
Mr. Chairman, Honourable Sir and Upasika, ladies and gentlemen, Su Vikranta Vikramin said, all beings are desirous of happiness. But outside wisdom, we do not see, O Lord, any happiness for any being. Apart from the mode of life of the bodhisattvas, there is nowhere any happiness for any being. The Buddha declared, in agreement with reality is this enlightenment of a Buddha. The thought of beings of inferior resolve does not stride in sublime dharmas, in Buddha dharmas. Those who are of inferior resolve and conceited abide in a condition which is contrary to the enlightenment of a Buddha. They cannot understand the deep Dharma. What could beggarly beings do with the precious Dharma? Beings destitute of learning or confused by their learning, beings who are but blind fools. The heretics of other sects and all the foolish common people are beggarly beings. All those who have sunk into the mud of false views, who treat the data of experience as signs of realities, who have strayed on to a wrong path. It is not possible, O Subhuti, that this discourse of Dharma could be learned by beings of inferior resolve, or by beings who have not taken the pledge of bodhisattvas. Only those who have taken the vows of the bodhisattva can learn the Dharma. When the Buddha asked Sariputra if it occurred to the Shravakas and Pratyeka Buddhas to think that after they had known full enlightenment, they should lead all beings into the realm of Nirvana, which leaves nothing behind, Sariputra answered, no, indeed, O Lord. But such indeed, said the Buddha, are the intentions of the Bodhisattva. And he went on to add that the light of the glowworm, like that of the Shravakas and Pratyeka Buddhas, cannot illumine the great continent, whereas the light of the risen sun, like that of the Bodhisattvas, can do so. A stark comparison. It would not profit us to speculate whether the comparison is justifiable or not, or whether it was even made by the Buddha himself. For us, it is pertinent and urgent to ask ourselves seriously why we turn to religion, and to find out if we have any understanding of the implications of living the religious life. Why do we turn to religion? Is it because we are hurt, sorrowful, frustrated, frightened, battered and defeated? Or is it because we are conceited, crazy enough to be militant evangelists, for this is the only field in which we can dominate others and inflate our own ego? Is it because we are confused and ignorant, see no meaning or purpose in life, and would like an answer? Or is it a self-indulgence in emotional and intellectual pleasure? Something to flaunt in our social circle? A status symbol? We must ask ourselves all these questions and find out the answers from within ourselves. Let there be no illusions about our motives. For each and every self-oriented approach to religion is false and self-defeating. It makes us agents of greater ill. What are the implications of living the religious life? In a sentence, the complete reversal of all worldliness. We have to grow out of our subhuman condition into the truly human state. In practice, this means the middle way, which is perfect asceticism. That is, putting away whatever obstructs the realization of the unconditioned. It means freedom from all self-indulgence, violence, ambition, and ill will, from fear, restlessness, and stupidity. It means constant mindfulness and clear perception of the fact as it actually is. It means one must never attempt to grasp or to fixate the becoming process, but allow it to flow past. And this too is the meaning of asceticism. It means the life of meditation, which includes all right action. It means abiding in friendliness and compassion. It means communion. Is it surprising then that Sakra said, "This Dharma is wonderful, O Lord. It is astonishing, O well gone. As contrary to the whole world is this Dharma demonstrated. It has been preached so that dharmas should not be taken up, yet the world is determined to take up dharmas." If the questions we have asked ourselves regarding our motives are satisfactorily answered, and the implications of the religious life are lived in daily practice, we will see that the context of religion is transcendence, the unconditioned, and that the spiritual life is rooted in and begins with saintliness. He who has dispelled sense illusions and seen through the elemental compositeness of all conditioned things and states realizes the unconditioned, nirvana. He is like a star, insofar that like a star, he is a self-shining light. Like a star. If we are close enough to a star, that star shines for us like the sun, a source of light and life and love. If we are not close enough, we see a point of light amongst a host of twinkles, an uplifting and inspiring wonder and delight. But the host of twinkles cannot support our life as our sun does. The Holy One is like a star. What is the measure, if measure there be, of our closeness to Him? Our purity, our whole purity. Then there is no dust in our space. The void is transparent. Our eyes are not on fire. Vision is true. And we see the light itself, a miracle, and not only the objective being reflecting the light. Like a star is the Tathagata, the Arahant, the Holy One, the Bodhisattva. Like a star is the Prajna Paramita. The oldest text of the Prajna Paramita, usually translated as perfect wisdom, is the version in 8,000 lines, the Ashtasahasrika, which probably dates back to 100 BC. Here it is written that the Lord said, "Perfect wisdom is the mother and begetter of the Tathagatas. She showed them all knowledge. She instructed them in the ways of the world. From her have the Tathagatas come forth, for she has begotten and shown the cognition of the all-knowing. She has shown the world for what it really is. The all-knowledge of the Tathagatas has come forth from her. All the Tathagatas, past, future, and present, win full enlightenment thanks to this perfection of wisdom." And it is in this sense that the perfection of wisdom generates the Tathagatas and instructs them in the world. Furthermore, the Buddha said, thanks to this law, all Buddhas know full enlightenment. Thanks to this law, all the wholesome ways of action, the jhanas and samapattis upheld by the limbs of enlightenment, the super knowledges associated with the limbs of enlightenment, in short, all the articles of dharma, the cognition of the Buddha, of the self-existent, the inconceivable cognition, all these become manifest in the world. It is perfect wisdom which appeases all evil and does not increase it, beginning with ordinary greed up to the attempt to seize on nirvana as one's own personal property. The Prajnaparamita Sutra is thought of as a treatise on the wisdom that transcends, or the wisdom that is gone beyond. In this connection, Mr. Harold Talbot, who read us a paper on Tibetan Buddhism last year, has given me permission to quote from an article which he kindly wrote for me recently. He writes, "The Prajnaparamita Sutra is the key document of the Mahayana, treating of emptiness and the wisdom which has gone beyond. It has denied the validity of all statements in the Buddhist scriptures, has insisted that the Buddha deliberately spoke about what he knew to be transcendent, not only to speech, but to thought itself. Anyone who aspires to Buddhahood sees that all the doctrine and practice of Buddhism is an error, a charade, and a distraction from awareness of the truth. What does the Prajnaparamita suggest in place of the T-nets which have been criticized out of existence? The answer is, of course, nothing. For, say the Madhyamikas, we will point out the emptiness of your religious or philosophical replacements. Is emptiness, then, to replace the criticized totality of religion and philosophy? Certainly not. Here is what the Madhyamikas say about the notion of emptiness. Form is empty in respect to emptiness. Emptiness is empty in respect to form. Emptiness is empty in respect to the distinction between form and emptiness. And emptiness is empty in respect to emptiness. Well then, what about replacing religion and philosophy with the wisdom gone beyond the Prajnaparamita itself? Here the Tibetans have made a wonderful contribution. The Prajnaparamita, say the Tibetan masters, is not to be thought of as wisdom that is gone beyond, not as the wisdom that transcends. It is referred to as that which transcends wisdom. That is Vajrayana and Sahajayana, naturally and fearlessly dwelling free of attachment to the thoughts in the mandala of spontaneously arising and dissolving forms. Don't get stuck in transcendence, in other words. Otherwise it won't be transcendence. This quotation from Mr. Harold Talbot's article will amply repay deep meditation. The Prajnaparamita, not dependent upon anything, is a self-shining light, a star. So too, the Tathagata is a star. For the Tathagata is incapable of deliberately taking life, of taking with the intention of stealing what is not given, of indulging in carnal intercourse, of intentionally telling a lie, of enjoying pleasures from savings, as when he was a householder. With the destruction of the cankers, he is incapable of going the way of desire, hate, delusion, and fear. The Tathagata is termed recluse, Brahman, discoverer, healer, stainless, pure, knower, freed, wholly awakened. The Buddha said, the Tathagata speaks in accordance with reality, speaks the truth, speaks thus and not otherwise. The Tathagata does not speak falsely. The Tathagata's speech is gentle, appealing and beneficial, mild, knowledgeable and mind-delighting. The Buddha is free of the fear of robbers or animals, whether in city or forest. He never forgets what has to be done by him. His mind is always well established in voidness, never separated from penetration into the nature of reality. The rain of his friendliness and compassion falls steadily and continuously upon suffering beings. He has attained the freedom in which there is the cessation of all obstructions, and he can never fall from this state of freedom. The Buddha knows directly, not by way of reflection or speculation, all that constitutes our sense-mind functioning. This is his all-knowing knowledge, sarvajnana, for which he is called the all-knower. He dwells continually in friendliness and compassion. He is the embodied Mahaprajna and Mahakaruna. What exactly is the Tathagata? A being or not a being? As to this, the Lord said, those who by my form did see me, and those who followed me by my voice, wrong the efforts they engaged in. Me, those people will not see. From the Dharma should one see the Buddha, for the Dharma bodies are the guides. Yet, Dharmahood is not something one should become aware of, nor can one be made aware of it. put in another form, who sees me sees the Dhamma. Who sees the Dhamma sees me. Like a star is the Buddha, the one who realized supreme enlightenment. Subhuti said, one speaks of enlightenment. Of what is this a synonym? The Lord said, enlightenment is a synonym of emptiness, of suchness, tathata, of the reality limit, of the realm of Dharma. The reality limit is that which reaches up to the summit of truth, to the utmost limit of what can be cognized, and which is quite free from error or perversion. Manjusri said, enlightenment is not discerned by anyone, nor is it fully known, nor seen, nor heard, nor remembered. It is neither produced nor stopped, neither described nor expounded. Insofar as there is any enlightenment, that enlightenment is neither existent nor non-existent. For there is nothing that could be fully known by enlightenment, nor does enlightenment or the enlightened one fully know enlightenment. Non-existent are all dharmas. That is a synonym of enlightenment. And it is thus that the realm of Dharma comes to be called thus. For, as the domain of the Buddha, all dharmas are non-separateness. Subhuti asked, how is enlightenment attained? The Lord said, enlightenment is attained neither through a path nor through a no path. Just the path is enlightenment. Just enlightenment is the path. Subhuti asked, what then is this supreme enlightenment? The Lord said, it is suchness. Suchness neither grows nor diminishes. A bodhisattva who repeatedly and often dwells in mental activities connected with that suchness comes near to the supreme enlightenment, and he does not lose those mental activities again. It is certain that there can be no growth or diminution of that which is beyond all words, and therefore neither the perfections nor all dharmas can grow or diminish. It is thus that when he dwells in mental activities of this kind, a bodhisattva becomes one who is near to perfect enlightenment. Let us recall what was said at the beginning of this talk. Apart from the mode of life of the bodhisattvas, there is nowhere any happiness for any being. Who is a bodhisattva? He is a being who lives not for himself, but is bound for full enlightenment, his own and that of all others. So it is, said the Buddha, with a bodhisattva who is full of pity and concerned with the welfare of all beings, who dwells in friendliness, compassion, sympathetic joy, and even-mindedness. Wisdom and compassion are the most powerful motive forces in his life. The great compassion characterizes his relationship and conduct towards all sentient beings, and perfect wisdom, his attitude to reality. The Lord said, doers of what is hard are the bodhisattvas who have set out for the benefit and happiness of the world out of pity for it. We will become a shelter for the world, a refuge, the place of rest, the final relief, lights and leaders of the world. We will win full enlightenment and become the resort of the world. With these words, they make a vigorous effort to win full enlightenment. Their meditation is prompted by the desire to fully know all dharmas. A bodhisattva is fearless in any situation, ready to cast away even his body and to renounce all that is necessary to life. He produces an adamantine thought thus: I should become one who never abandons all beings. Towards all beings should I adopt the same attitude of mind. All beings I should lead to nirvana. But even when I have led all beings to nirvana, no being at all has been led to nirvana. For one should look to the fact that all dharmas are neither produced nor stopped. Everywhere should I train myself to accomplish a penetration into all dharmas, to the consummation of the one principle of all dharmas, of the perfections, the unlimited states, the jhanas and samapattis, the super knowledges, the 10 powers, the grounds of self-confidence, the special Buddha dharmas. Supported on this thought, the bodhisattva will cause innumerable beings to achieve the highest, and that without depending on anything. Moreover, the bodhisattva produces an adamantine thought thus: for the sake of all suffering beings, I too will experience their sufferings until they have all become released in the realm of nirvana, which leaves nothing behind. Afterwards, I will fully awake to the utmost right and perfect enlightenment. As a savior of all beings, should a bodhisattva behave towards all beings. Wisdom and compassion are a unity worked through the practice of the 6 perfections, the paramitas, that is, methods for going to the beyond. They are generosity, morality, patience, vigor, concentration, and the 6th, which is the master paramita, wisdom. The bodhisattva takes this great vow: however innumerable sentient beings are, I vow to save them. However inexhaustible the defilements are, I vow to extinguish them. However immeasurable the dharmas are, I vow to master them. However incomparable enlightenment is, I vow to attain it. Energized by this vow, the Bodhisattva realizes the full fruition of the paramitas. Like a star is the Bodhisattva. We have often used the word dharma, a word of many meanings. Let us look at some. One, dharma is a transcendental reality. For example, nirvana. Two, it is the order of law of the universe. For example, all compounded things are impermanent, not ultimate reality, sources of suffering. Another example is the teaching, hatred never can be appeased by hatred. It will be appeased only by non-hatred. This is an everlasting dharma. Three, it is a truly real event, the objective truth. As such, a dharma carries its own definitive mark and is identical with it. Four, it is the moral law. Five, it is the doctrine. Six, dharma is a technical term for the events, happenings, or facts which an analysis based on the conventions of the Abhidhamma reveals as ultimately real. It is an event of sensory or mental experience. The deep waters of the Prajnaparamita are very deep indeed. The Lord said, the Tathagata has fully known all dharmas as not made. It is just through their essential nature that those dharmas are not a something. Their nature is no nature. And their no nature is their nature. Because all dharmas have one mark only, that is, no mark. For this reason, all dharmas have the character of not having been fully known by the Tathagata. For there are not two natures of dharma, but just one single one is the nature of all dharmas. And the nature of all dharmas is no nature, and their no nature is their nature. It is thus that all points of attachment are abandoned. Well might Subhuti exclaim, hard to understand, O Lord, is the perfection of wisdom. To which the Lord replied, because nothing is fully known by the enlightened. Again, the Lord said, all dharmas are situated in space. They have not come, they have not gone. They are the same as space. Space has not come nor gone. It is not made, not unmade, not affected. It has not uprisen, it does not last, not endure. It is neither produced nor stopped. The same is true of all dharmas which are after the fashion of space, non-discriminate, because the emptiness of form and all other dharmas neither comes nor goes. For all dharmas are situated in emptiness, and from that situation they do not depart. They are situated in the signless, the wishless, the ineffective, in non-production, in no birth, in the absence of positivity, in dream and self, in the boundless, in the calm quiet, in nirvana, in the unrecoverable. They have not come nor gone, situated in immobility. They are situated in form and in other skandhas, and in the full enlightenment of arhats and pratyeka buddhas. Let us hear just a few more statements from the Prajnaparamita for furthering the happy discomfiture of the logical, discursive, concept-making mind. In the ultimate sense, there is neither karma nor karma result, neither production nor stopping, neither defilement nor purification. Manjushri said, Buddha, self, non-production, the trackless are all synonymous terms. The Buddha is the same as speechless silence. The Lord said, Bodhisattva, perfect wisdom, form, etc., are mere words like magical illusions. They are not, do not arise, are false to behold. All that is conditioned is like flashing meteors, a fault of vision, a dream, a bubble. What then of the unconditioned? Subhuti said, like a dream, like a magical illusion, are all beings, all dharmas, objective facts. So also is a fully enlightened Buddha, even Nirvana. And if perchance there could be anything more distinguished, of that too I would say that it is like an illusion, like a dream. For illusion and Nirvana are not two different things, nor are dreams and nirvana. Such is the principal message of the Prajnaparamita, the unconditional identity of the conditioned and the unconditioned. The Prajnaparamita is concerned with the Absolute. What can one say about the Absolute? You can say whatever you think might reasonably be said about it, provided you will also cancel out each and every statement by saying the opposite. Any and every proposition, as well as its opposite, is affirmed and also denied. the result? The void, the shunya, the empty, or the bindu, the drop or no thing which has no boundary, no dimensions. So, the non-finite, unconditioned, non-dependent, not relative, absolute. Do we thereby know the absolute? No. The absolute is the unknowable, for all knowing is caught within the net of the relative, the perishing. What is the use then of this prajnaparamita? The supreme use, for it can spell complete liberation from bondage to the known and the knowable. How is this possible in view of what has been said so far? The liberation does not come just by making statements followed by negations of these statements. Mere words are impotent. When the mind is utterly pure, empty, transparent, it is itself the truth, the living fact, to which the words or thoughts are only pointers. This is liberation. It is simple. Even as a perfect song, beautifully sung, is simple.
Mr. Mehta warned us that this talk would be difficult. It has been difficult, but the fault is ours. To some of us it may have seemed wisdom, prajna wisdom, manifested by a mind at home on that plane. We must learn to rise in consciousness to that plane. And there we shall understand better what we have heard tonight. For many of us, this has been a lamp lighted in the darkness of our unawareness, and we are grateful.